Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 97. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about The Jungle Book. Not the original Jungle Book, not the original animated Jungle Book, but the new Jon Favreau Jungle Book. It's very popular. People are really loving it, including our guest, Gene Goswerder from Real World Theology, and J.R. Forresteros from The Storymen, and Origami Elephants, and the Bible Bites podcast, and every other podcast probably on the internet. So, we have a great time talking about the comparisons to the animated film, and how those changes kind of affect ratings, and how they will affect younger viewers. We kind of dance around the subject, and almost tackle some of the tinges of racism in the original, and how they may have addressed that in this version, and so much more. So, make sure you guys are checking out realworldtheology.com for new reviews, top five lists, streaming recommendations, more podcasts that come out on the 1st, 10th, and 20th of the month. You can get daily reviews and all kinds of other content there, so it's really great. Check out our Facebook discussion group at Real World Theology on Facebook. You can also find us on Twitter at Real World Theo. Please subscribe to the podcast, and please, please, please like our podcast. Review the podcast, 5-star reviews, give us your thoughts and comments, help other people find us and join the conversation. We would appreciate it. So this is a really great show for you. I think you're going to love it. Here it is, episode 97, The Jungle Book and Interpretive Racism.
Yeah. Wait. So when did you go see the movie, JR? Monday?
Yesterday.
I was wondering if you were going to actually, you said you could see it on Monday. I was like, does Amanda want to go see it?
She did want to, but since yesterday was Alien Day, we went to a big screen double feature of Aliens last night. So she was like, yeah, that's enough movies in the theater for me this week. So.
Wait, that was Monday?
No, that was last night. And Monday, we didn't get to. I don't remember why. So I went and saw it yesterday afternoon.
Oh, before you went and saw the Alien stuff?
Correct.
Okay. That makes more sense then. Gosh. I bet you went and watched it at like a Alamo Draft House, didn't you?
It was at Alamo Draft House. My dessert that they brought out was called In Space No One Can Hear You Ice Cream. And the central feature of the dessert was a green cream stuffed Cadbury cream egg.
Hmm. Nice. Well, that really seals it. I really need to move to wherever Blaine lives so I can go to the Alamo Draft House.
Mikey.
Oh, I want to see, gosh, now I can't remember where Blaine lives, and then I'm sure Blaine will listen to this at some point. I want to say it's Lubbock. Isn't it Lubbock?
There cannot be an Alamo Draft House in Lubbock, Texas.
No. It's not San Antonio. What else is out there? What else is way
Austin?
Out?
Austin?
No, it's not. It's not. It's south. It's like
Alamo. Oh, he does live in Lubbock. There's an Alamo in Lubbock?
Yeah. See, I know what I'm talking about.
I mean, that just boggles my mind.
Well, you can't have one in North Carolina. That's all I know, because people would get confused about which draft house to go into.
You know, Mikey, honestly, the best way to ensure that there's one in the triangle is for you to just move.
Yeah, that would be the way to do it.
Yep. As soon as the ink on the paperwork was dry, they'd be like, coming next week.
Oh, actually, well, I think we're in, this is going to sound like a brag, but I think we're in a lot better shape than Gene is.
Way better shape.
Yeah, where you guys have, Gene? one theater, right?
Lebanon, Indiana. We got one theater in town, 7 screens, and the nearest thing that shows anything good, like maybe a midnight special or something, is like a half-hour drive. And normally my movie nights are Thursday nights. Everybody in the house is asleep, so I just go catch a movie. So half-hour drive there and back, I'm home about 1 a.m., and I wake up about 5 to go to work. So that doesn't typically work too well.
Gene, if it makes you feel any better, I live in Dallas, and everything is minimum 30-minute drive for me.
Yeah.
That may be just because of traffic. So,
No, it is. Totally it is. But I just, if that makes you feel any better, like, it also takes me 30 minutes to get to and from the movie theater.
That's so crazy, though, because, like, when I'm out there at my dad's house, it's one of those things where everything's cookie cutter. So I feel like you should be able to get everywhere, in, even with traffic, like, 10 minutes, because it's, like, Walmart, McDonald's, something that you can only find in Texas, movie theater. Walmart, McDonald's, some, you know.
Well, there is a movie theater that is a 5-minute drive from my house, and it is a very nice movie theater, mm-hmm. but it is not an Alamo Draft House.
So it's, yeah, so you're not going to get to see the wacky, and not the wacky stuff.
But well, we're going to the AMC 30 tomorrow night to see Purple Rain. So, okay. I mean, like, they do some cool stuff, mm-hmm. but not like, okay, so the next double feature the Alamo is doing is The Muppets Take Manhattan and Jason Takes Manhattan.
Goodness.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I just feel like whoever runs those places actually enjoys watching movies.
Well, that's it, right? It's a movie theater run by movie lovers.
Yeah. So, you know, because, I mean, you go to your normal theater, no matter how nice it is, it's typically, you know, teens or college kids who are like, theater 6 down the hall, you know.
Yeah, I'm always like, how's this movie? And they're like, I don't know.
I don't know, I saw it like 6 times, whatever. It's
what do you
dumb.
Mean? You haven't watched it?
You can watch all these movies and you haven't? Have some popcorn. Well, so the good thing about where I do live is there are 5 theaters, I would say, within a 10 to 12 mile radius of my house.
So you live in a pentagram of movie theaters.
I do. I am the center of the, well, actually there's a movie theater that if you went out the back or in our little development or subdivision or whatever it is, there's a road that's a dead end, like way down in the bowels of our subdivision. And if it was not a dead end and they would have taken this road and paved it through the field where it dead ends into, it would connect to the road where the theater is. So as the crow flies, I'm like a quarter mile from a theater. But because there are no roads to it, I have to like go out of my subdivision, go down the road about a mile and a half, and then drive down a side road back about a mile. So, but no one ever goes to that theater because it's kind of crummy. So
nice.
It's a Carmike.
Is that where you saw Jungle Book?
No. I saw Jungle Book at the theater I see most movies at, which is the Palladium.
Ooh. That sounds fancy.
Doesn't it sound fancy? It almost sounds like Paladin, so you know it's kind of like a good guy. Which makes sense. Nope.
No, I got it. I'm with you.
No, you shouldn't have been with me. That was terrible. But
I'm very forgiving on jokes.
Well, so we found out once we started doing Real World, my wife and I, we found the theater that actually gives you some kind of reward for going, as you know, as little as it may be. And at least for the theaters around here, the Regal Theater, you can actually watch enough movies to earn free movies. So,
Nice.
So it takes going to like 6 movies or so. Which, you know, the normal person doesn't see 6 movies very often, but, you know, I see 6 movies in a month and a half. So every other month I get a free movie ticket. So,
right.
Nice. All my theater offers is like free popcorn and drinks.
Yeah.
Well, which isn't too bad.
You can use it on that too, but I'm like, free movie tickets, right?
Yeah. Actually, don't let me do that.
But, I did have to go see it pretty late at night. The schedule around the Fissel household is much different than it used to be.
And I bet.
Blah, 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 baby yeah, now. Blah,
I know.
Blah.
I mean, I enjoy everything about it, and it's not a complaint. It's just it's a different crowd that I'm used to seeing at the theater, you know. Usually, if I would go see The Jungle Book at, you know, like 8 o'clock or even a matinee on Saturday, I would see a specific age group, a type of person. But when you try to go see The Jungle Book at, you know, 10:30, 10:45 at night, I expected no one to be in there, but then when I saw who was in there, I kind of wished that I had been right the first time.
Wow.
Like, I think there were two couples that expected no one else to be there, so they could kind of snog in the back of the theater.
I love those couples.
Nice.
Yeah, so...
This is good because whenever I go on a Thursday, I'm seeing these new releases like the night before they have their like technical widespread release.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you've always got some of those people that go see the movie. So normally, and I kind of cheat sometimes for our Fantasy Movie League draft. It's like, okay, there's 10 people in this theater. If I extrapolate that by blah, blah, blah for the whole nation, how many tickets is this going to sell? Okay, I'm going to buy this one.
And it works for you whenever you remember to actually
nerd it all out.
Your
thing. Yeah, dude. I don't know what happened.
Fantasy Movie League, sign up.
I've big time dropped on that.
I think you came in first last week, so you called your way back in. I think you're in the top five or so. So it's okay.
Yeah, me and 70% of all other users.
All users. Hey, it's okay. So
just feel bad.
So JR, you actually saw it in the middle of the day. Gene and I probably saw it really late at night, so we all had non-normal crowds.
I've seen it twice.
I saw it in 3D.
Oh wow!
At the Mesquite 30, and it was a like 2:30 afternoon show. We were my buddy DeMac and I were the only two people in the movie theater.
Huh. Well, I guess 2:30 on a Tuesday, it didn't necessarily surprise me.
That's like prime kid time. If you have like single mom or stay at home moms with little kids.
Well, I mean. Like, but it's like, but so it's PG, but it's a pretty hard PG, right?
Yeah.
What I've been hearing is like at least kids should be at least 6 or 7.
Yeah.
Yep. I think it's a hard PG. I mean, I when I got done seeing it, I was kind of leery to let my two older kids see it. They're 8 and 6.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of warned them, my son, especially the 8-year-old, he's just more, he's more sensitive to violence and like the scary sounds and dark scenes. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of had to tell him like, hey, Mowgli's going to be okay here. It's going to be a little scary for a minute, but he's going to be fine. Like 3 or 4 times I had to tell him that. So yeah, I'd say it's a scary PG. I think in my review, I called it one of the scarier PGs you might see this year.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so that's interesting because I mean, it's been a long time. I did not get a chance to watch the animated version again before, like I wanted to. But
yeah.
I mean, when's the last time either of you guys saw the animated version?
20 years ago.
20 years ago.
Probably within 2 or 3 years.
Okay. Is it because Gene? Is it something that you've been watching? You watch with your kids?
Yeah, we watched it when my kids were a little younger. They go on spurts, like they'll catch on to a movie and watch it like for a full week, 3 or 4 times a day. And so it's ingrained in my brain once again. We went through a whole week into this with Pee-wee's Big Adventure a few months ago. So, yeah, I go through spurts of that kind of stuff. So it was the animated was somewhat fresh in my brain. And it's funny how those musical numbers come up and you just like – it's like, you know – the Fresh Prince theme song. It's just, you automatically know it. You're singing it word for word.
You're there. Well, so do you actually enjoy the animated version, Gene?
I mean, I enjoyed it a lot when I was a kid.
Not as much when you're an adult or like.
Definitely not.
But the songs. Because it was, you're going to tell me, just tell me.
Well, the songs still kind of took me back to my childhood. And thinking about it and stuff, but I felt like the rest of the movie was just kind of boring.
Mm-hmm.
The conversations didn't carry much weight. But to be fair, I don't think they were really meant to necessarily. I felt like it was meant to be a pretty watered down version of that story, in the sense that, you know, Shere Khan can be this menacing, scary tiger as we saw in this one.
Mm-hmm.
But in the animated, he's not really that scary. He's a little playful at times, and there's really only once or twice where he really kind of lashes out. So things like that kind of tell you that they really lightened it up a lot. So, and as an adult, it just doesn't carry the weight or anything that you would hope it could.
In the animated version, doesn't Shere Khan like wear like a crown and have like jewels on his fingers and stuff like that? And it
you may be thinking of Robin Hood.
Robin Hood. It's like all the same to me. Movies I haven't seen in 20 years.
I'm going to have to ask you never again to compare Robin Hood and Jungle Book. as equal movies because Robin Hood is one of the greatest Disney animated movies ever.
I just can't remember either because it's been so long. So, JR, you apparently remember enough about The Jungle Book from seeing it 20 years ago to have some kind of impression from it.
I mean, when I say I saw it 20 years ago, I don't mean to give you the impression I only saw it once 20 years ago. This was definitely one of the, you know, my grandma had the whole, you know, all 20 Disney animated movies mm-hmm. that were out at the time in the VHS big boxes that had the hidden pornography on them. Yeah,
I was aware of this.
Oh, you weren't, Gene? Oh, man. There's some, like, several different boxes have, like, hidden penises and things drawn into them by the artists. Like,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's pretty.
Come on, people.
I would say hilarious, except it's just really, like, terrible.
Yeah. This is, like, Fight Club esque.
Like, 21-year-old me thought it was hilarious. Adult me is like, wow, really? That's, like, criminal. So anyway, all of that to say, I watched the cartoon a good number of times. It's got a couple of really great musical numbers in it. And I liked it a lot. Though I had the same reaction watching the new Jungle Book movie as I remember feeling about the old animated one, which was like, eh.
Okay. Oh, man.
Like, the story was fine. There wasn't anything wrong with it, but I didn't get excited about it, and it doesn't resonate with me. So I was just like, okay.
Okay. Well then let me preface it by, or let's preface that piece of the conversation like this, because, you know, they brought in Jon Favreau to do a live action version, and Disney's really been up on remaking lots of these live action things, and they got a great cast to do The Jungle Book. And I remember not really caring for The Jungle Book, the animated movie, that much. I didn't really get into the songs. I thought the story was kind of boring, at least how Gene kind of described it when he watched it as an adult. That's kind of how I felt as a kid. I didn't really want to see it over and over. But there's so many great actors and just people. And like I said, I typically like most of the stuff that Jon Favreau does. So I was like, how can I not go watch this? But with that said, what were the expectations you had, knowing who's attached to this new one, knowing how you felt about the animated? Did that kind of shape how you experienced the film at all, JR?
I don't know. Like, I went into the movie ready to like it.
Because of who was involved or because of how you...
Like, I liked the original. And I like Jon Favreau. I like most of the actors. The only casting choice I wasn't wild about was making Ka a woman and, like, kind of sexualizing her a little bit with Scarlett Johansson.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, that was a relatively minor gripe. And I went into it ready to say, like, okay, I'm going to enjoy this, but I guess at the end of it, I just didn't, that story, it was so, and Gene, you kind of already said this, like, it was so generic, like, the story was so generic, I just didn't care. Like, at the end of it, I was like, okay, that's the thing that happened. All right, like, I didn't hate it. The animation was phenomenal, but,
oh,
like,
goodness.
I don't know. My wife was like, how was it? And I was like, it's fine. I didn't like it, whatever. I mean, it wasn't as bad as Batman v Superman, so that's a win.
Barcelona.
I know, right? Yeah, too soon. Sorry, too soon. No, like, it, I don't know. Like, I don't, I'm going to probably sound so negative on it. I'm not. Like, it was good. But I, like, I'll probably forget I saw it by next month.
So it's really interesting that you put it that way, because it was sitting at almost, you know, a perfect rating on Rotten Tomatoes for like the first week or so it was out. And it's still really highly rated and critics are really positive on it. And like I said, I was not super interested in the story. I remember when they announced it and I was like, meh, I guess, you know, but then, you know, like I said, but then I saw, you know, if you attach Bill Murray and Idris Elba to something, I can't not go see it at this point. So I was going to see it. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's good. That's cool. I like that. But then when I left the theater, I was like, okay, that was a decent movie that I'm not going to super highly recommend necessarily to people, or I'm not going to get excited about when I describe what happened. But I don't really have any complaints about it. And I'm trying to figure out, is that because my expectations may have gotten too high? Or...
Well, what do you guys think it was because that the story told in this one was too similar to the 67 animation? Or were you looking for something more different? Or what do you think it was?
Well, so I'd ask you the same question, Gene. What were your expectations?
Well, I didn't need the casting at all. All you had to do was tell me that Disney's doing a new Jungle Book, and I'm on board.
Okay.
I've made no secret that I'm over the moon about what Disney's doing now with reimagining some of these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, like this one, getting back in some parts, getting back to the original source material. But so yeah, I didn't need to know any of the casting, and then when I heard some of the casting, like especially Idris Elba, when I heard Christopher Walken was being King Louie, I was like, ooh, that'll be very interesting. Some of those voices, and Bill Murray too, are so different than the animation voices. Phil Harris, I think, did Baloo, and he's got this very like sort of booming baritone kind of voice, and that's not Bill Murray at all. So some of those things got me more excited than I already was, but I didn't need any of those to already be excited about it. I like the angle that this story takes, you know, exploring an orphan boy raised up in the jungle by people who are not his own, and what's that do to this kid? What's that make him want to be? How do they react to him? All that kind of stuff. I think there's a lot of really interesting things you can do with that. And so I was on board right from the start.
And it met your expectations?
Yeah, it did. I thought it was very good. I gave it a 4 out of 5 on my Letterboxd. And I would recommend it to pretty much anybody. It was a very solid recommendation for me.
Hmm.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't not recommend it. I mean, yeah. If nothing else, it's the best CGI you'll probably see in a movie this year.
Think so this year? Pete's Dragon, man. It's coming. Except okay, I saw a picture of the dragon.
Yeah, it doesn't look great. It looks like a cartoon in a live action movie. When I saw that trailer, I didn't know what it was, and I was hoping it was a Sasquatch movie. Because it's all like in the forest. And it's like nice. The kid knows there's something in the forest. And I was like, the most logical thing here is the Sasquatch. And then I was like, never mind, it's a dragon. Okay, sure.
Well, then you got the Big Friendly Giant trailer and not quite a Sasquatch, but...
Yeah.
So, Friendly Giant. The BFG.
That's right. That's what friendly... F means friendly, Mikey.
Okay. That changes everything.
I mean, yeah, Civil War is going to look great. Obviously, Rogue One's going to look great. But this is going to be up there. I mean, we've never seen animal CGI look this good.
Mm-hmm.
By even close.
We have.
Oh,
I think.
Dang.
What about Paddington? Did you see Paddington?
I didn't see Paddington.
Oh.
You got to see Paddington. Because I think...
Okay.
I think Paddington is as good or better than Ooh. What's here.
Well,
and that's the bar I had set when I went into watching this. Paddington and Rise of the Planet of the Apes, because I thought that was very well done too. So that's where
mine
my bar was set.
Mine was the Bear for the Revenant, and this was as good. if that bear and Shere Khan could fight, I'd be in.
Oh man, what a matchup.
What if the bear and Shere Khan have an epic rap battle?
Perfect. I'm in. I want to see it.
Now. Do it.
Clay Morgan, my housemate and Storyman co-host, suggested that we view The Jungle Book as a prequel to The Revenant, and then it gets a lot more disturbing.
Yeah, I think I've already said that. That was hilarious.
Oh. So, Gene, you were talking earlier about one of the things that was drawing you into the movie in the first place. Was the entire idea that Mowgli growing up away from civilization would kind of have to learn about who he is from, you know, from animals or from nature. And I'm kind of extrapolating what I think you were getting at. So did it, I don't want to say did it meet your expectations because we already asked that, but did it explore that enough for you?
I think it did. And I think that there's more that could be explored. But I feel like they kind of hinted towards a sequel perhaps. So I'm kind of anticipating more of that coming perhaps. But it did. It stayed, you know, thematically, it stayed fairly true to the 1967 animation. And most of that was related to kind of this familial bond he has with the wolves. And so, like in the beginning of the movie, for example, he is kind of scolded for doing things as a man would do, like trying to, you know, build things or even running the wrong way, you know, taking the wrong path or something. And he is scolded because they're trying to form him into this member of the pack that can act with the pack as the pack acts in order to protect the pack, right? That's part of their whole thing. The strength of the wolf is the pack, and the strength of the pack is the wolf. Mm-hmm. So if you're not a wolf, then how can you be a strong member of the pack? So they're trying to kind of form him into something that he's not, and he is in turn trying to go along with that. You know, he buys in and he tries to become like a wolf. And then, you know, throughout the movie, he's, especially, you know, as he meets Baloo in particular, he starts using his ingenuity and his creativity, and that becomes encouraged by Baloo, whereas before that was kind of all shut down. So that's one aspect of his humanity that they explored when he started discovering that he could do good things with these natural talents that he had. Then I think, you know, it gave him confidence. It made him kind of want to naturally explore more about it. So I feel like it did well. I think it did a good job of exploring some of the things that would kind of naturally occur, because he's going to want to identify with the people that raised him and with the people that he's around. Mm-hmm. But at some point, it becomes clear that, okay, he's something different. He's something else. And what is that, you know? So.
So I think one of the things that really stood out about that particular part of it is the fact that they hit on this, maybe duality is not the right word, but I'm going to use it, and because, you know, whatever. And that where you're more valuable, in a pack, but yet there's a very strong individual piece or mm-hmm. component to it. So it's not just that, it's not putting out there, be yourself, do whatever feels right to you, and you'll overcome just by being the best you can. It's also, but realize there's more to you than just you, but that you have something to offer. Mm-hmm. A larger kind of setting, which reminded me of a terrible movie that I saw last year called The Good Dinosaur, which seemed to say you're more valuable with the pack and you need to conform to the pack, or you have no value, especially to your father, who is a terrible father and hates you.
Man. I wanted to take you to task on that. I wanted to.
This is your chance. This is
no. This ain't the Good Dinosaur podcast.
Thank the Lord. I mean, as much as JR would appreciate talking about the Good Dinosaur.
Gosh, I hated that movie so much.
Yeah. No, I didn't particularly like it, but I think, not that you're wrong. I totally saw what you're saying and. To a degree, I agree, but I think there's another side to it too. Anyways, The Jungle Book, guys.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with Eugene that, like, the tool making and the innovation that they played as intrinsic to what it means to be human were mm-hmm. was really clever. And how everyone keeps saying their tricks and, like, being very dismissive about them, right? And making them hide those things. I wish they would have equated that a little bit more directly with fire, because no one seemed particularly bothered by the fact that it is man's ability to innovate that lets him control fire. It was more just that he was a man in general, and every time he used tools, it reminded the animals of that. You know what I mean?
Because it was sort of a magical thing that he could create.
Right. And the red flower was, that was the looming threat of the whole film, you know? So I wish they would have tied that a little bit more explicitly, that the animals are actually a little bit afraid of Mowgli as he's growing and as he's developing these innovative abilities, because they know where that leads.
Right. That's the threat, and it's the motivation for right. some of them. And King Louie right. wants it. Shere Khan wants him out because of it partially. So yeah, that's a good point.
Do you think there is something more to it, that it's possible that they're actually maybe insinuating that man's ability to innovate is dangerous, or it you know, it always borders on that line of useful and dangerous?
You know, it's interesting that I think that's something that can and should be said, and that's like the classic setup for every science fiction movie mm-hmm. that goes wrong, right? Like to you know, Ian Malcolm, we were so busy asking whether we could. Yeah. We never asked whether we should. Yeah. Like that, I mean, that, right? So sure, but I don't think so in the Jungle Book, because obviously the fire gets loose and in the end, but it's explicitly because Mowgli doesn't know anything about it and hasn't mm-hmm. been in the man village. Like, they have the fire and it's fine. Like, they have it under control. His dad has the fire in the flashback that we see, and it's mm-hmm. under control. So there's never a point where it says, actually, humans aren't trustworthy with this thing. It's more, humans are dangerous because of this thing. And again, in a major departure from the animated movie, it's when Mowgli rejects the tool that his humanity has equipped him with, and like denies in some way his humanity, that he is able to unite all of the animals into a pack.
Yeah, that was one of the bigger distinctive differences with the animated, that he made that choice. And there's some, I read some people have some kind of worldview concerns with that, right? Because how much does Mowgli identify with the animals, and does this create an issue? Because in Kipling's original, which I haven't seen, I haven't read. Have you guys read that?
Extensive summary reading today.
Okay. That's kind of what I did too.
I have made it clear that I do not know how to read.
Well, I haven't read it, so this is kind of a summary from commentary that I've read about it. But in Kipling's original, Mowgli is kind of, like we've just been talking about, the domineering figure. The animals, you know, they can't even hold eye contact with him, apparently. And he's kind of written as better than all the animals. And he leaves the jungle a little later as a teenager to be with other people. And in the animation, he's not really domineering or presumptively better or anything like that. But he still leaves to be with those who he belongs. And, of course, he uses the fire, the tool of his kind. And today in this movie, Mowgli's, his individuality as a man with his talents of creativity and everything mm-hmm. are central to his arc. Even though his humanity wins out in that he embraces what he is, right? He's not a wolf, and he stays in the jungle instead of returning to the village. So I think that goes along with his use of the fire, deciding not to use the fire, you're throwing it into the river. So people are kind of concerned, like, is that potentially sending a message about a incorrect relationship between man and nature, like mm-hmm. like Mowgli?
Animals are people too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that and or maybe devaluing what it is to be man, something like that. Did you guys pick up on that at all, or you think that's unwarranted or anything?
Given that the animals are already talking in this film. I didn't read it that way. I actually read it as much more of a Disney doing everything in its power to spin the Jungle Book as not like an inherently racist story. Okay. You know, because Kipling wrote the poem White Man's Burden, where he said, right, it's our duty as white people to go and civilize the Dark Continent. And this is the same guy that wrote the Jungle Book, which is ultimately about a savage who grows up in the jungle as an animal who eventually joins human civilization and becomes a man. Right. And then in you know, the film came out in 1967, the animated one, and there's a lot of language in the original cartoon about you belong with your own kind and staying with your own kind. And then in the end, Mowgli joins his own kind. Like, that's how the movie ends, is he leaves the forest and joins the human village. And it's good that he's with his own kind. And there's a lot of debate about whether, like, to what extent Disney was racist. You know, was he just a product of his time, or was he, like, especially racist? I tend to lean more towards, like, product of his time. You know, the Jungle Book was like the last movie he had a hand in. It came out a couple months after he died, you know, so it's not that surprising that an older white guy in the mid 60s was all about a movie about people being with their own kind. Like, that's like, that's pretty standard for that time. So all of that to say, like, when I read the end, like, I was really surprised when he threw the torch in the river, and then he, like, did this whole, you know, say the wolf pack motto together and like unite all the animals, and then he stays in the, I was like, oh, huh, because that totally instead of it saying what's good is that everyone stays with their own kind, in the end the message of this Jungle Book, the 2016 Jungle Book, is we're better when we all together and work together and use our differences and celebrate our differences and work together. And that's like the exact opposite message, which I appreciated a lot.
Huh. Well, do you think it's because maybe the people behind the new version of the Jungle Book saw a movie that came out late last year that strongly emphasized needing to be with your own kind above friendship and things like that? I can't remember what it was called.
I can't either. No. No, honestly, I mean, about dinosaurs. All jokes about The Good Dinosaur aside, like, when the movie was first announced, there was this huge flurry of people that were like, why are we remaking this movie? And, like, how are you going to make it not racist? And so that was surely in the screenwriter and in Jon Favreau's mind, you know. I mean, I don't know how it couldn't have been. And, I mean, again, I was really happy to see how they changed everything. Yeah. Even to the extent that they excised a lot more of King Louis' song than they wanted to, as you could tell by including it in the credits, you know, but there again, you have a, like, a kind of a jazzy song sung originally by a black man that is in the mouth of a monkey saying, I want to be a real man like you. Like, again, in 1967, that's super problematic. And so they more or less turned it into like a spoken word piece in the film, and then just kind of did the full song at the end. That's one of the two big songs in this movie. So I would be surprised if that didn't hurt. You know what I mean? For them to make that decision. But
Right. Was that a black man that sang that in the 67? I was reading it was an Italian guy.
Was it? Okay. Name. I thought he was black.
I think from what I was reading, there's a lot of like insinuations that this is supposed to be Louis Armstrong.
Right. Well, yeah, King Louis, right? Yeah.
Voiced by Louis Prima. I don't speak Italian. A white Italian.
He's white Italian. Okay, there you go.
And there was a really good kind of quote from, oh gosh, I'm sorry, I'm looking through some notes that I took down. There's the lady who directed the Jungle Book musical, Mary Zimmerman. In 2013, she kind of made a comment that she got a lot of fire for, that she was talking about how the racism is in the eye of the beholder, and she got a lot of flack for that. And when she kind of got a chance to further explain or distance herself from that, she was talking about some things that people assume in what they're watching. I'm going to read her quote here. She says, many people believe was voiced by Louis Armstrong, but was in fact conceived for and voiced by Louis Prima, a white Italian-American. And then she says, I challenge the assumption that King Louis was a derogatory depiction of a black man, given that what is on screen is only an ape. And I know an ape is a common representation there, but mm-hmm. she says, what is on screen is only an ape drawn in a style consistent with all Disney animation of the period, voiced by a white musician singing to a little Indian boy. She says it's more accurate to say that the race of the animated King Louis is in the eye of the beholder. So there's, and I was curious about that because when I saw it as a kid, of course, as a kid, I don't think any kid would watch that and necessarily see racism. But even when I watch it again as an adult, the animated version, I don't necessarily see racism. I think if you know Kipling's background with the story and other things that he's written, you could definitely make that jump there and say, okay, this is what is happening here. This is why King Louis was added in into the animation. So, yeah, I was curious what kind of what you guys thought about that, if that was like a blatant out front thing or if that was maybe something that we read into it.
Yeah, it's definitely not blatant. I mean, that like, I think even something like Sebastian the Lobster in Little Mermaid speaking with like a clearly Jamaican accent is more blatant. And that's not even, again, he's red, mm-hmm. right? So it's definitely not blatant, but to your point, like it's when you know the context and when you see like the time that this movie came out and who got called monkey in our culture and the right. kinds of cultural things that were associated with the people who were called monkey, it becomes like, to me, at the being as generous as it is possible to be and more generous than Disney deserves, it's like a gross mistake and a gross oversight. Mm. Like the best thing right. you can say is someone wasn't paying attention. But again, when you look at films like Song of the South and some of the other like history that Disney has with like really, really racist depictions of specifically black culture, you have to ask like, well, how unintentional was this?
Hmm. Yeah,
and again,
why
did someone say, hey guys, like, let's write a different song?
Well, JR, would you say that at least in the Jungle Book that we have now in 2016, it is the main thing that they do to address that problem is that dealing with King Louis's character? Are there other things that they also do that kind of downplay some of the things that you could read into?
Oh no, I mean, I think changing the whole ending went even further than what they did with King Louis.
Okay,
you know, and it's kids. Thankfully, kids who are growing up today don't hear their parents and their grandparents referring to African American people as monkeys nearly as often as would have been the case in 1967. Mm-hmm. Black kids are not referred to in that way on their way to school or at school or by people when they're walking down the street nearly as often as they were in 1967. So our cultural context has changed dramatically for the better. And so I think all that helps make what, to Gene's point, like you look at this and like there's nothing explicit in the text of the film that you can say this is definitely racist. Like it's all implication, it's all context. And so between what they did to diminish the King Louis stuff and what they did to like how our culture has changed, I think it's gone a long way. And I looked around on the internet over the past few days getting ready for this podcast looking to see people who were like noting this stuff, and it's just no one's talking about it. Like mm-hmm. it seems like we were all really concerned about how Disney was going to handle this, and
it's like a non-issue.
They did a good job. Like they, you know, at least this time they got it right. Good job, Disney.
Well, that is until Disney puts out the action figures for the Jungle Book, and there is no Ka, right?
Right. Yeah, that's what I'll
you can't find Ka anywhere.
Speaking of Ka, did you guys stick around for the credits and hear Scarlett Johansson singing that song?
No, I missed that. Dang it.
Oh, it was beautiful.
I heard about half of it.
Oh, you didn't like it, probably. Come on, Mikey.
I was tired.
I thought it was so good.
He has
good.
A kid now, Gene.
I have a kid now, Gene. My world has changed. I have so many. I have an excuse for everything now.
Man, I'm glad I don't have three kids to hold me down like that.
They hold you up, Gene. They hold you up.
No, in the credits, though, I think it was after. I can't remember if it was before or after the King
I think
Louis.
I think it's after King Louis.
Yeah, because he comes out in the open book and everything.
Yeah.
So, but it's after that. So, yeah, she sings the whole song. And it's beautiful. She does so well. And I started even thinking, why wasn't this in the movie? But then I was thinking back on her scene, and I thought, well, I thought that was pretty perfect. And JR, you noted that it was sexualized. Do you think that they sexualized Ka? Or, because I got more of a, like when she's like trying to make him feel comfortable and accepting, and I got more of a maternal vibe, like she was letting him know she was going to protect him, which of course she's like bringing him in for the kill and everything. But I got much more of a maternal vibe from that than a sexualization.
I wanted it to be more maternal, but maybe it's just because Scarlett Johansson is like our contemporary Marilyn Monroe, that like whatever she does gets sexualized by association, which I'm fully willing to own that that was my issue. But I don't know. Like I was much more worried about it when I saw the first trailer, and I was like, why did they make Ka a woman? And I don't understand, like, why choose Scarlett Johansson? Like, she's again, like,
voice.
Well, yeah. Well, it's
which
hard.
Voice?
Well, I mean, it's hard because after her being in her, like, there's...
and Black Widow and like whatever that alien movie she was in, like, I mean, that's she's a pretty readily. I don't blame her for this, but
yeah.
Again, she's a pretty readily sexualized person, and her voice is that like husky, breathy, like sexy kind of voice. Again, I didn't notice it in the actual film nearly as much as like I put a comment in when the trailer first came out, and I was like, don't like this. Oh, okay. Like snakes are already kind of you know, sexualized like a little bit.
Well, I've got a quote here, JR, that says, anyone who sees sexualness in a voice is really bringing that to the voice, because voices are just voices.
I feel sad for whoever wrote that, who's never heard a sexy voice.
Well, I mean, like it's why some people find German sexy, right? Like the two people that find German as a romantic language.
Yeah.
The two people. Nice.
No, so I mean, like, it did raise a red flag for me when they made Ka like a woman, but in the movie it didn't actually bother me.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. So, my antenna were up, and when we got to that scene I was like, but it was like, I was like, okay. And it was a good scene. Like, it was scary.
Yeah, it was.
You know, like it did everything it needed to do. And you're right, Gene. I missed the song because I like the song, but I didn't miss it in the scene.
I prefer her singing it over the original. Honestly, it was that good.
And I found it on Google Play Music, so I'm going to listen to it as soon as we're done.
Yeah, that's probably the only song that I prefer this one over the original. We can get into that later, but yeah, I really liked it. But her scene, I mean, the camera work that they did there was excellent too, because they're kind of rotating sort of around the jungle and the landscape. And you're seeing he's in the midst of trees, right? And it's dark. It's like sunsetting kind of thing. And you mistake all these trunks and limbs for what are these things? We know who's coming. Is that actually Snake I'm looking at? And they did a great job of building up that that tension a little bit.
Well, Gene, earlier in the episode, you'd mentioned that some people, whoever they are, we'll put that in quote, mate. You know, some people were upset because there were possibly complications with the worldviews in this in this movie. And I think that can stretch from anything from the pack mentality, or the little, you know, spiel that the wolf pack kind of says, the law of the jungle. It could raise some red flags depending on what you believe about how nature works, about the agreement right. that they reached at, for the Peace Rock thing. And then there's a whole there's a faction of people. I think it's just the same faction of people who have a problem with everything. They're the Starbucks cup Christians or whatever. Like the you can't ever actually find them, but someone's complaining about it. The sure. people that had an issue with the spiel about the elephants creating everything.
Ooh, I do want to talk about that.
Yeah. So that's what I guess that's where what we're couching right now. What worldviews that this movie could espouse could actually be problematic specifically to us as Christians? Like, are there problematic worldviews in this, or are we overreacting?
You want me to go? Go, JR.
I'll say that one specifically. So Mikey's referencing an article I'm assuming he's posting in the show notes mm-hmm. from a Catholic believer who again said, like, I've heard people, like, he wasn't even advocating this position, but he was saying, like, it's pagan creation myths because we have, like, Bagheera right. narrating the creation of the world by elephants. And mm-hmm. like, even he was like, this is like, you're just looking for something to complain about at that point. Like, I'm like, you're going to a movie about talking animals. Like, at like, you can't complain that they're being anthropomorphized and that they have creation myths. Like, and to his point, like, no, I don't. Like, if your kid comes out of that movie being like, I didn't know the world was made by elephants. Now I believe in the elephant god. Like, you have bigger problems than that you took your kid to the Jungle Book. Like, that, like, this is clearly a fantasy movie. It would be like complaining about Lord of the Rings for the mythological framework it builds. Mm-hmm. I guess it's different because it's Jungle Book is set in our world, except it's not because animals don't talk in our world. So, like, I'm genuinely confused by Christians who would be upset by something like that, because it is, to me, so clearly a fantasy world. And maybe it's because I read a lot of fantasy, and in fantasy, you always have, like, a mythological construct for your whatever world you're in. And so, like, what kind of mythological construct are the animals of the jungle going to have? Sure, okay, elephants, I guess. Like, I wouldn't have predicted that, but whatever. Like, I don't know why the elephants weren't, like, cool like all the other animals, you know, but I was fine. Like, that didn't even bother me for a second. I was just like, huh, okay, I guess the animal, I was like, I guess the elephants are going to put out the fire at the end of the movie, like, with their trunks or something.
Well, like, I think it could be something where, you know, we see, okay, so, like, you see an actor or an actress playing a role, and then they play a very similar role in the next movie, and another very similar role in the next movie, and you start to kind of get this thought in your mind, like, okay, I know about who this person is, I know what they're like, even though they're only acting and they're faking all of this, you know, because they're doing it so well and they do the same kind of stuff, you know, you feel like you get to know them. And so when you meet that person in real life and they're nothing like you think you know them as, then it's like a big shock, a disappointment, or whatever. And so I think something similar can happen when we see movies that are very clearly set in a fantasy world, like you were saying, but they make statements about the origins of that fantasy world or the origins of the universe, whatever, and we take that to be a statement about how the director or the writer actually believes reality is, you know, when that's not at all what they're saying. They're putting together this story and they're setting a backdrop for it. That doesn't mean that they think that, you know, elephants created everything, or, you know, so I think that we can all fall into that trap sometimes, you know, presuming that a director is making some sort of a, you know, philosophical statement when really they're just trying to set up some interesting story. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of all that was there. And with the elephants, and the same with the Peace Rock scene, something I learned is that those are actually, you know, those are very different from the animation. Neither of those were in the 67 animation, but they were in Kipling's the second Jungle Book. So that's actually cool. A return to some source material. And I didn't realize that at first. You know, when I wrote my review, I was like, man, they added in so many unique things and added some originality to it. And they did, based on what today's generation knows this story. We all know the animation. So they did. It was original to us, but actually they're just going back to the source material. So those elephants being kind of a creator sustainer type creatures is just a return to how Kipling originally wrote it.
So it's almost like Easter eggs for all the hardcore Kipling fans out there.
A little bit, or the ones who just studied little cliff notes over him the last 3 days.
You know, the Peace Rock was one of, it was one of the pleasant surprises of the film, because they did not hold your hand and explain the rules of the Peace Rock. You know, they didn't say, well, when the river gets low enough, the Peace Rock comes out, and because there's not enough water, everyone has to have this truce. Like, it was all in there, and they gave you hints, but I was surprised that for a kid's movie, it was relatively less hand-holding than I expected. And yeah. I liked that.
Well, what do you think a kid would take away from that? I mean, do you think that they would be able to say, like, oh, man, maybe this is, like, a more betterer world where everyone can just like get along, you know, because they have higher needs.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it was, I did wonder, like, one thread that was never really picked up was when they all warned Shere Khan that he knows whose jungle this is and whose laws he's breaking.
Mm-hmm.
I assumed that meant the elephants, but like that never, he was never punished by some higher power. Yeah. For breaking any laws,
yeah.
You know, so I was, when they said it, I was like, gosh, I wonder what they mean by that. And then when they said the elephant thing, I was like, okay, I guess it's the elephants. So I kind of just kept waiting for some kind of payoff, and that never happened. So now I'm still back to wondering, like, what are they talking about? You know, if there are laws, there has to be a lawgiver, and the only person or persons that the film gave us is the elephants. But they didn't seem at all concerned with what anyone else was doing.
Yeah. Why didn't they show up and take out Shere Khan?
That's what I mean. Like they're like that was, it was like a Chekhov smoking gun that never was fired, you know?
Because these elephants can't talk.
Yeah, apparently not.
Or they can, along with... but they're like the ones that they just never, they're like Silent Bob, you know? They only say like one thing during the
what
entire
they
movie.
Need to say. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but they trumpeted a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
Sure did.
Yeah, that was going to be my come on, was like that.
Well, don't give it away.
I won't.
It's already there. Gosh.
I'm saving it. Anyway. Yeah, so like I think what a kid would take away from the Peace Rock thing was like people can compromise, you know, and you had Bagheera specifically say to whatever the antelope things or whatever they were, like, I know the rules, I know the truce, like, I'm just here to drink too. So yeah, I think that was great. And how, and again, Shere Khan was clearly the antagonist who was threatening the truce. Gene, am I right in remembering that when he kills Akira, that it was more graphic in the cartoon? Like, if they spent a little bit more time on it
in the cartoon?
Yeah.
I don't remember that happening at all in the cartoon.
Oh, I'm like 90% sure it did.
Okay.
I remember it. I mean, you like, don't hold me to that, 'cause like I said, it's been a while, but when that scene happened in the movie, I was like, oh yeah. Or like, and I just remember it being like a little bit more clear that he was definitely dead. Kind of like, well, Mufasa, you know?
Yeah. Right. Just laying there. You could be totally right. When I saw that in the movie, that was one of the first indicators to me that they're taking this much darker and much more serious than the animation, because I did not remember that in the animation. Like, I feel like Akira was in the opening scene of the animation, and right away they're kind of talking about what to do with Mowgli, because they had already received the news that Shere Khan had returned. There wasn't a Peace Rock scene or anything like that, but then after that, I don't remember ever seeing Akira again. I mean, Mowgli leaves with Bagheera. He gets caught up with Baloo, King Louie, and Ka, and Shere Khan comes in then. I don't remember ever getting back to the wolf pack like they did numerous times in this one.
Yeah.
I could be way off. Maybe I'm just forgetting it. So
keep speculating because I'm reading it right now.
I'm going to tell you this. I actually invented as a child an entire sequel to Pinocchio. And like in my mind, like I must have dreamt it one night, because in my mind I just had seen Pinocchio 2. And I was probably like 15, and we were talking about, like, you know, animated movies, and I was like, well, yeah, like Pinocchio 2, that was one. And everyone was like, there's no Pinocchio 2. And I told everyone the plot of it, and everyone was like, that movie does not exist. And I had to go look it up, and I was like, wow, like I apparently just invented this entire animated movie that I was sure was a thing. So it's possible I invented this scene also. I may have a whole animation studio in my imagination.
That's
so
great.
According to the Wikipedia page for Akira,
Akira, not Akira. That's the anime.
Akira is the anime. Yeah, I just let y'all slide. You just going with it. Yeah, we could have got angry comments about it. That's what I'm hoping for. it says in the animated 1967 Disney adaptation, Akira only has a brief role at the beginning of the film, when the Council of Wolves meet after Shere Khan's return to the jungle to decide what to do about Mowgli's future. Acknowledging Shere Khan on their own, they decide to send Mowgli away with Bagheera.
Yeah. And so, you know what? That's another difference, too, in this one, is that they don't send Mowgli away. Mowgli offers to leave.
Yeah.
So there's an interesting thing, too. He's distinguishing himself apart from the pack, even that early on. I want to get back to these elephants.
You get back to the elephants, because we're going to have to wind it down soon.
I got like five more things here. Really? So why do you guys think that, if that's in the source material, the elephants being the sort of creators of the jungle and everything, but it wasn't used in the animation, and in the animation they were kind of like bumbling sort of comic relief kind of things. You got Colonel Hardy or Hottie, and he's this like general that bosses people around, but he doesn't really actually know anything, and his wife elephant is like whispering behind his back, like giving the real orders. And in this one they get back to the source material, and it's such a like a somber reverence for these creatures. I just wonder why that decision was made to do that now, and if that says anything about the film, about what we should take away from it, whereas that wasn't even in the animation. You guys think there's anything there, or I don't know.
Well, go ahead.
No, I was gonna say, I'm just trying to figure out when the second Jungle Book was released.
They were all like short stories.
1895. Yeah.
So if you're finding the Jungle Book, I'm assuming that's like the compilation of the stories.
Well, it says because we're saying that the elephant thing was in the second Jungle Book.
Yes,
right. Like, that's what like I was. Second like, story.
Yeah, the book called The Second Jungle Book. So when they make The Jungle Book, the animated 67 feature, I assume they're just doing it from the original one. So if you want to put elephants in there, do whatever you want to. They're not really, you know, looking over at The Second Jungle Book to get some
extra stuff. But the Jungle Book series ends with Mowgli entering the human village. So if they're doing that, like they're pulling from across the spectrum.
Mm.
Is my understanding. I, you know, a part of it I wonder is, you know, elephants have become more sympathetic these days because they're like on the verge of extinction, and it's like not cool to hunt ivory anymore. And
yeah,
part of it might be that. I don't know when Dumbo came out, but there might be some of that in the animated like baggage. I don't know. Part of it may also be that they needed a way to put out the forest fire, and they thought like the easiest way to do it and stay true to the stuff they had to work with was to introduce like the elephants as the creators, and have that in the background, so that when they're rerouting a river with their tusks and trunks, it's got some kind of early act one referent, you know?
Yeah. They're still sustaining everything by doing that.
Yeah, and it's just not out of nowhere. It's like, oh, it's like the Eagles in Lord of the Rings. It's like, oh, well, yeah, I guess Eagles can show up now. Why not?
Like, why not? Where were they at the beginning of this thing?
I don't know why they didn't fly them all the way to Mordor. Who knows? Like,
yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. Because in the animation, it just rains at the end and the fire is out. And it's like, oh, how convenient. It just starts raining.
Right. Yeah. So, I liked that they gave us this act one referent. And then in act two, he helps the elephants with his human innovation. And then in Act Three, like the elephants come in and pretty believably and not out of nowhere save the day.
Yeah, they've already set it up for it. Yeah. The only thing I could think of is, you know, it adds to the story, like you were saying, it's believable in there. But I was kind of thinking too, like outside of all this, like outside of even the story, you know, this movie's taking place in a jungle in India, and the central religious representation in India is Hindu, like 80% of the people. And in Hinduism, the elephant is a sacred animal. So if you have elephants today acting the way they did in the 67 animation, when today marketing movies overseas is a far bigger thing. You run the risk of probably offending 80% of one of the most highly populated countries in the world if you treat them the way that the 67 animation did. Which I thought was still endearing and funny, but I also don't worship elephants, so I think that's oversimplifying it, but that kind of reduces it. The reason we don't have a Hup 2 musical number is chalked up to pagan sensitivities and marketing strategy.
I like to think someone has that written on a big whiteboard, like in the production room, like pagan sensitivities, and it has a list of things. Well, I mean, for all the talk of the elephants in general, I think something, and I'm definitely not the first person to recognize this about the movie, but even though the elephants are given all this credit for being basically all powerful and all creating, the one thing that they didn't do or not given credit for is creating Mowgli. So he's still set apart, and something else obviously created him, and he's not a part of the jungle. He is, like I said, set apart to some degree, and they obviously don't go anywhere with that, but there is something to it, whether it just is supposed to emphasize his division from, you know, the packs that he's been running with, or the division between, you know, the animals and man, or the idea that maybe an unsaid something about man puts them at a higher level than even the elephants, because Mowgli wasn't afraid to go help the elephants and wasn't crushed for trying, you know.
Right.
Like he was in a place of not in an inferior place to the elephants, because ultimately they needed his help. So
right.
If the elephants created the jungle and everything in it, and the mountains and the rivers and all that stuff, Mowgli is one step above. We're not sure how he's created. Yeah. We're not sure what the Jungle Book says about that, at least in the 2016 movie, but there is something else to it. So
yeah, it's interesting that in their mythological world, there is no place for humankind, right? I mean, they're not in the creation myth. And even there, you see, like you said, the alleged creators are stymied by their inability to innovate. And it takes a human being who enters in from the outside for them to find a kind of salvation.
Mm. Well, with that,
does that keep everyone happy? I know you have a lot of super conservative listeners that were really mad at this episode, and they were waiting to make it okay to watch it.
Drinking out of their non-Starbucks.
That's right. Yeah.
Christmas cups. Yeah.
So, hey, I'm a conservative listener. I'm fine with that.
Oh gosh.
I knew Gene was super mad about the creation myth stuff. I was like, he's gonna be fuming.
He's like, literally.
No, I thought it was great because, and I to some extent I see people like getting their feathers ruffled a little bit, but you got to understand, you like you said, JR, these animals are talking. This is not real world thing. You're telling a story here, and you can tell a parallel story about creation or about a creator and a sustainer. You can tell a parallel story with other things. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think what Mike, you were kind of hitting on it there, that sort of draws out that Mowgli is different and separate and apart because the elephants had to rely on him for something. You know, there was something they couldn't do. They're supposed to be the creators of all this, and they couldn't do this one thing, and Mowgli could. So I think there's a lot to that we can draw out. And we can go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it seems like probably all of us, and I think this is sort of the ethos of the podcast in general, is we would prefer to find things to celebrate rather than saying, oh, you know, Christians didn't make this movie according to our particular theological paradigm, therefore it's bad and no one should see it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we tend to do the former and say, well, yeah, look, we watch stuff all the time that wasn't made from a Christian perspective, but we're going to find the good in it and celebrate that anyway.
So, well, and if we can't do that for something like this, then, like you mentioned before, we would have to throw out Lord of the Rings. We would have to, I'm not sure if this will make the actual show, but we'll have to throw out The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you know? We'll have to throw out Aesop's Fables. Like, we don't get any of that, you know?
Are we doing an Aesop's Fables episode?
Maybe.
All right, I'm in.
I'm actually trying to think, well, does Disney have the rights to that?
It's public domain.
Oh, okay, then they'll make it. They'll make it. They'll run out of ideas again in a year or two.
Tortoise and the Hare, it's coming. Yep. Watch out.
Well, so with that, I know that there's a couple more things that we could explore, and it would be great, but we'll have to do that in other venues like our Real World Theology forum and stuff, our discussion board. Or the comment section of this episode, because we're gonna run long if we don't start winding down. So we're gonna do that by asking JR what his come on moment was from this movie.
I didn't understand which animals could talk and which animals could not talk. And they sort of tried to explain that when Mowgli asked the little squirrel things that steal his fruit. He's like, do you have a language? So it's like, apparently all the animals have their own languages, except when they were at the watering hole, everyone spoke the same language. So I'm assuming that was like Swahili. It was like a common trade language. But then like none of the monkeys except for King Louis spoke it. So is this some kind of like fascist dictatorship where he controls access to knowledge so that he's the only one that has access to the common trade tongue? Or why don't these squirrel things know it? Or were they just refusing to speak it so that they could, you know, abscond with his vegetables or his fruit more freely? Like, so many questions. And there did not seem to be a rhyme or a reason. And so I was just like, come on.
No, I think the more, the better metaphor would be more like the medieval Catholic Church when they were still having everything in Latin and they wouldn't let the Bible be translated. So they held all the power that way. I think that's King Louis in this movie.
Yeah. But like even the baby rhino apparently knew Latin in your metaphor.
Yeah. Because why would a baby rhino not know Latin? Come on, JR.
I guess I never thought about it that way. Come on.
Oh, Gene, what about you?
Okay. My come on moment was, unfortunately, I know a lot of people love this, but for me, Baloo's Bare Necessities musical number.
Really?
I hated that. I love Bill Murray, and I didn't love his voice as Baloo right off the bat. Right off the bat, I didn't like it. But I eventually warmed up to it, and I felt like it gelled perfectly with Baloo's personality and stuff. So I was fine with it. But when it came to singing that song, I thought it was a mess. It sounded like it was ad-libbed in all the wrong places. He's like on beat and then off beat again, and then he's on beat again. It's like he was trying so hard to sing it, which is contrary to the nature of Baloo anyways. Baloo wouldn't try hard to do anything, and he's like really straining at singing this song. It's like, okay, just relax and sing along, you know, just sing it. Don't try to, like, I don't know. This just isn't his style of song, and I think rather than work something into his style, it seemed like they tried to mold him into the tempo and the peppiness that the original had when Phil Harris sang it, which, by the way, was an Academy Award nominee, if you can believe that, for best song. I felt like Bill Murray's rendition just kind of butchered it. I didn't like it at all.
I will say, Gene, just in general, I never didn't hear Bill Murray. I never got lost in the Baloo character I did with the rest of the actors.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
I was always Bill Murray doing Baloo, which I enjoyed because I like Bill Murray.
Yeah.
But there was always a layer of actor between me and the film when he was speaking.
Yep.
Well, so the interesting thing about that to me is that I don't really like that song at all. It's one of those songs.
What?
When it gets in my head, I get mad and I try to think of something else.
Now I get mad.
I'm like, I'm just gonna I'm just going to think of the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air theme song instead.
I can't believe you get mad. Mikey, you're the exact kind of person that needs that song.
I'm going to start texting you lyrics from that song all the time.
I'm going to text you back Fresh Prince lyrics. It's going to be the
best
conversation
I like. Ever. I like Fresh Prince. Now, if you were texting me Creed lyrics, we'd go to war.
Now we know. Now we know, folks.
Now everyone write that down. we're going to go to the mattresses over that. No, well, see, so when he sang this song, it sounded like every song that I've ever heard Bill Murray sing. It sounded like Bill Murray singing a song to me.
Yeah.
Which I don't necessarily think is all that great, but I think it's very Bill Murray-esque. Which, you know, it seems like we're all kind of in agreement that he was not our favorite part of this movie.
No.
But he didn't really detract from the movie to me. It just, I think JR put it really well. All the time I thought I was watching Bill Murray, not Baloo.
Right.
For what that's worth.
Right.
But I would say if I had to have a come on moment, the thing that just didn't sit right with me, it didn't necessarily make me say come on, but was when Shere Khan killed Akela. Because it was almost throwaway. Like, there was all this build-up about how, like, the pack was going to stand up against him, and they're all, like, growling. I was like, and there's literally 30 of you guys, or something, you know, something dumb like that. Like, just gang tackle him. Like, I don't care how, you know, it's...
They tried that at the end.
Yeah, and I thought that was pretty weak sauce, too, because I was like, I think y'all could have done better. It was basically like watching a martial arts film where the bad guys...
I was just thinking of that.
Yeah, the bad guys only come in, like, one at a time. I was like, thank goodness for that.
Now, come on, guys. Take turns. We brought 30 of us here to make it fair.
Yeah. I mean, so that's kind of how I felt. I mean, and so you have henchmen wolves, okay? I get henchmen wolves being thrown off, but...
Are they not just hench wolves?
Or hench... well, I think most of them were men wolves.
So. The gender is important of the hench wolf to you.
Well, they wouldn't let the lady wolves be in the wolf army.
She was apparently Alpha Wolf at the end, I guess. Why not?
She's in the wolf army.
Well,
biology functions differently in this fantasy universe.
There's another worldview problem.
I know, worldview problems. I wanted Akela to at least put up a fight or something, but it was just like, bye. It's just like he got punted off a cliff. Like,
I really enjoyed the idea that a wolf pack is fundamentally powerless against the tiger. And all Akela can do is, like, reason and appeal his way out.
Mm-hmm.
And Shere Khan is having none of that. Like, it may not have been, like, the most believable from as far as biology goes. Like, what could these animals actually do?
Mm-hmm.
But I thought story-wise it was great.
Well, so that's why it's not really a come-on moment. Because ultimately it gives, like, gravitas to Shere Khan.
Totally.
You know, yeah. he just took the alpha out as if it were not even a thing.
Yeah.
And
well, and I think part of the reason it was so quick was because they were trying to hold on to that PG-13.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. I was like, wait, okay, he's dead, right? Right? Is he dead? Okay, yeah, I think he's dead. Okay. They're acting like he's dead. Okay, I think he's dead. You know, like, I just wasn't sure.
Oh. Well, so, ending on a high note, JR, what was your favorite part of the movie?
My favorite moment in the movie was when, right before we meet King Louis, and he picks up the cowbell. And I was like, yes! Like, this is the most out-of-place, hilarious, like, kids are never going to understand that or care or notice. Yeah. But it was, like, the most... I was not expecting this movie to be meta. And when he picked up the cowbell right before Christopher Walken voiced King Louie, I was like, get out of town. Like, what movie am I watching right now?
Yeah, it's like the wrong movie to be doing those kind of cross-references.
But it was the only one. Like, it was the only one in the whole movie. And so I was just like, okay, someone wanted to have fun with that. Like, that's hilarious. So I loved it. And it was like the weirdest thing. But it was hilarious. I liked it.
All right.
My favorite moment was Shere Khan's opening introduction scene at Peace Rock. Idris Elba masters the stern, cruel, bloodthirsty nature in his opening speech there, and everything about it, from like the beginning matter of factness of it. You know, he He walks in and he's just, I can't help but notice this strange odor today. Like he's just like curiously wondering upon this pack of animals here, and its progression of intensity to where he's leveling threats against Mowgli through clenched teeth. And I just, man, I loved it. Elba nails Shere Khan. And you know, I haven't seen Beasts of No Nation, so it's arguable that I've yet to see Elba's best role. But right now, this is my favorite role from Idris Elba, hands down. I loved his voice work as Shere Khan.
Yeah, I still think his best stuff is Luther, but I've not seen Beasts of No Nation.
Luther.
Luther? Have you not seen Luther?
I don't think I have.
Oh, you should.
Oh, you should. It's good.
Oh, it's...
Is this more recent, like 8 or 10 years ago, Luther?
Yeah. No. It's not a movie. It's a... Well, it's BBC, so it's movie.
Yeah, it's like,
okay.
Yeah, it's like three movie episode seasons, basically.
Okay, like a Sherlock Holmes type thing.
Yeah, something very similar. I remember just recently talking or describing it to someone, and I was like, before Laura and I started watching a lot of British TV shows, Luther was one of the first things we found, and I remember watching. I was like, oh, great. Another procedural, and I kept doing the thing all through the show, being like, well, this is what's going to happen next, because it's a stupid, you know, police procedural, and every time I was wrong, I was like, oh, man, this just got real, like, things weren't happy, people weren't all hugging at the end, and people were making tough choices, and Idris Elba was, he was incredible, I mean, he still is, but...
Yep.
So that and a close second, obviously Pacific Rim, you know, that's an Academy Award snub.
We all love that movie, right?
Yeah. When you cancel the apocalypse, you go straight to the top of my list.
Yep. I can't wait for Pacific Rim 2.
That's right. I don't care how they bring it back. I just want it to be like, anyway, it doesn't matter. So my favorite moment wasn't actually a moment. It's basically it's something we've touched on many times throughout this episode, which is just the how good this movie looked. Every time like Bagheera and Shere Khan fought, I was totally in. You know,
how'd they get the camera that close to those animals fighting?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it looked really really good. Totally transported to these really cool jungle places without thinking that I'm watching just like a. You know, a CGI animated movie. So, you know, kudos to everyone who was involved in that, from, you know, the director to the graphics guy to the dude bringing the bagels to the graphics guy. You know, whatever it took to make that happen was pretty incredible. So,
not just with the animals either. Every amount of scenery there was CGI. Trees, grass, everything.
I mean, like I said, it just looked great. It was immersive. Which
yes,
is
totally perfect
you know, so
did you guys see it in 3D?
No.
Is it pretty solid in 3D?
Oh, it's great. Yeah, it works really well in 3D.
Seems like it would.
Well, Gene and I don't make that fancy pastor money. We can't just be throwing money away at 3D.
You guys, I've always said, if you want to get rich, go into ministry.
Rich in the spirit? Like,
at least you get the best parking spots.
Treasures in heaven. Oh yeah. So with that, we wrap up. JR, is there any final thoughts about the movie that you'd like to convey? Anything we missed?
No. I would just like to reiterate. I thought it was fine. You won't be sad you saw it, but you probably won't remember you saw it a month later either. So,
what's well, our because you're watching Civil War next month and you're going to
Do you guys have any predictions about the Jungle Book movie coming out in 2018?
Oh, yeah. I didn't even bring that up. I was going to mention that. That surprised me. I didn't know that was coming.
From Warner Brothers. Because Rudyard Kipling's books are in the public domain now.
Yep. I just don't see how it could be, well...
I don't... I mean, I literally at this point... have no idea what to think about it because I didn't care that this Jungle Book movie was coming out.
Yeah.
Though, again, I'll have forgotten it by the time 2018 gets here for sure. So I'll probably, like, if you have me back on for that movie, I'll probably say, I can't, did I see the 2016 one? I think I did. And you'll be like, yeah, you're on that episode. And I'm
like, okay. Was that the one that was really racist?
Yeah. And oh, no, you're like, no, that was the 67 one. Okay, no, okay. Yeah, I think I probably just thought it was just okay, just like this one.
Well, if it, this might excite you all more. I think it's, isn't it Andy Serkis's, like, debut directorial film?
Yes. And he's voicing someone, I think.
Baloo. He's Baloo.
Oh, there you go.
Cumberbatch is Shere Khan, Christian Bale is Bagheera, Kate Blanchett is Ka, another female snake. Yeah, so another good cast. I don't know though, I'm not as excited because I was so pleased with this one.
Yeah,
honestly, I love the Batch, but I can't imagine him doing a better Shere Khan than Idris Elba.
No,
really, he did a pretty good Smog.
Yeah, pretty good. I mean, I agree with Gene wholeheartedly about Idris Elba.
Oh, it's Warner Brothers doing it. I just realized Warner Brothers, who's doing all the DC stuff, right?
Yes.
So they're gonna take Jungle Book and they're gonna they're gonna make it wholly unenjoyable.
It'll end with Mowgli eating live tiger,
yeah,
like roasted over a fire,
yeah,
and cackling with blood dripping down his face, and everyone will be like, "Wasn't that fun? Didn't you guys have fun at that?"
Yeah,
it was so fun.
All the kids will be like, "Can we go see the movie? It's rated like hard R."
NC-17. They had to cut it. Yeah, don't worry. The director's cut will be NC-17.
Yeah.
And Mowgli makes it to the man village and finds his mother, and she actually works at Star Labs, and he becomes the Flash.
Oh man, I'm getting more excited about this one, you guys.
JR just imagined a whole sequel in his mind.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not the first time.
Wait till you guys see it. It's
gonna won't be so the last.
Blow your mind.
Well, Gene, was there anything that you wanted to?
Well, I would just say that I thought it was super solid. I thought it was a successful rendition. I mean, it brought the sort of live sort of action to this, and I thought it was really good. I mean, I highlighted in my review a lot of talk about. Can you guys hear me right now?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry. I heard a little beeping. Sorry. I highlighted in my review some talk about how the fellowship that Mowgli kind of required to complete all of his tasks is similar to how Christians need to lean on fellowship of other Christians. You know, you don't find Christians going it alone. So check out my review for kind of a little more explanation on that. But I thought it was really good. I was very happy with it. I would highly recommend it.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things that really that you can take away from this film, that even though it's billed as the law of nature, I mean, if you take some of that masking or facade away from it, it's some pretty basic things that I would say that we could get behind, like, we need something bigger than ourselves. We need others to kind of, we need a community around us. We need, but it helps that we've been all given individual talents to bring to that community to make something bigger than ourselves. You know, things like that, that I don't think are very far reaching and would really jive with Christians. So not bad. I do think it's kind of fine. I feel about the Jungle Book like I felt about Cinderella last year.
I thought you were a little higher on Cinderella.
No, well, that's what I'm saying. I enjoyed Cinderella. I thought Cinderella was fine. Both the story of Cinderella and the story of the Jungle Book have never been my favorite stories. I've never wanted to like revisit them. I've never really wanted to hear them. Of all the fairy tales or, you know, myths or fables or whatever, it's not really high up on my list. But of all the Cinderella versions that I've ever seen or heard or whatever, the one that I saw last year was probably my favorite. The same holds true with this version of the Jungle Book. I've never really cared for the 67 cartoon all that much. The book wasn't really going to do anything for me. So as far as if I'm going to have to watch the Jungle Book, this is the version that I would probably recommend to people.
I was thinking about, like, for me, it was like, I loved Sleeping Beauty as a kid, the Disney Sleeping Beauty.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked Maleficent a lot more than most people purely because it was like a reimagining of that story that I loved as a kid.
Yeah.
Same as like what Gene, when you said this was a totally solid movie, or I think he said super solid. I was like, yeah, like I totally agree with that. It was solid. And then what you said, Mike, you totally resonated with this. I just don't care about that story. Like kid grows up in the jungle, raised by animals. Like, okay. Like there's people that would probably get really excited about that. And they probably love this movie. I'd be like, cool.
Right.
Like, I'm super glad you did. Like it didn't really do it for me, but not because the movie had any faults. Like it was a very solid movie.
Yeah.
Well acted, gorgeous visuals. So yeah, like it was great. It's fine.
Yeah. I mean, right. For something we're not getting, well, at least JR and I are not getting over the moon about, you know, when you think about what our come on moments are, it's not like we were like, oh, this huge plot thing, just ruin, you know, terrible writing, you know.
They ruined the character of Superman for all time. Yes, nothing like that.
Oh, you know, so yeah, it's nothing egregious. It's, you know, it's just when a movie is solid, super solid. But so with that, we think we're so thankful that you guys have stuck with us this long. And I know that you have probably enjoyed a lot of what JR and Gene have said. So with that, I want them to give you ways that you can follow their work or interact with them. So Mr. JR Forresteros, how can our listeners follow what you do or interact with you in the greater world that's not CGI animation?
Well, I'm on Facebook and Twitter at JR Forresteros. And I blog and I podcast at NorvalRogers.com, which that's Shaggy from Scooby-Doo's real name. If you want to find that and can't spell it, just Google that. And you can find all the podcasts I do at NorvalRogers.com/podcasts. I have one called Storymen where we do pop culture and theology. I have one where we review horror movies. So if you're a movie person and you want to hear us talk about horror movies, that'd be a place to go. I have several others. You can check them all out at that page.
Awesome. Awesome. Mr. Gene Goosewiser. How can people find you?
I'm glad you can pronounce Farver's name correctly, but not mine. That's great. That's great. I'm on Twitter, Wizard of Gaz, Wizard with no A. I'm on Letterboxd too. Find me there. I write monthly on Real World Theology. I also blog and podcast on clearlens.org. It's a Christian apologetics website. Yeah, I think that's it. And the Real World discussion page on the group page on Facebook, where if you say something that I disagree with, I will humbly ask you to be booted from the group.
But humbly, so it's okay.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I say please
with
when I ask.
Say with Christian charity.
Yes, in Christian love.
There get you out go. Of here. Well, you can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. You can also find me at Letterboxd in our Facebook discussion group. So join that if you haven't already. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you've enjoyed it. Subscribe to it either way. Even if you didn't enjoy it, please subscribe to it. And leave us a review. We really, really, really would love for you guys to review the show, especially on iTunes. 5-star reviews are awesome. It increases our ratings. More people will find the show. More people will join the conversation. That's awesome. So thank you very much, JR. Thank you much, Gene, for being excellent guests. And please, guys, make sure you're following them on social media and around the web. They've got great work, more than just what they did on the show. So thank you so much for listening to this episode. Thank you for taking time to make us part of your week. And until next episode, please remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
See ya.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
Now, I do have to say, Mikey, leaders are readers, so you should make it a habit of reading in life.
This is how much Google knows what we're doing right now, because I typed into Google, are there, and the first thing is bears in the jungle.
Nice.
And the second thing is bears in India.
Perfect, man.
That is...
That's either super convenient or super creepy.
Convenient.
A sloth bear, which are native to Indian jungles.
Well, look at that.